Hello, everybody, and welcome to this month's CIO live stream, whether you're tuning in on our website or on LinkedIn. I'm Kieran Ganesh, Global Head of Investment Communications here in the UBS Global Chief Investment Office. And today we're going to be diving into the year ahead. We've just published our outlook last week, and we've called it the Roaring 20s, the next stage. The decade so far has been something of a roaring 20s. We've seen a strong rally in global stocks, nominal GDP is up, corporate profits are up, and now as we're approaching the midpoint of the decade, the big question we're asking ourselves is whether US political change and other factors are going to lead that roaring 20s to extend or transform. So in this session, we'll be sharing our top ideas for 2025 and strategies for success in the years beyond. As usual, here on the CIO live stream, we're joined by something of a dream team of investment experts from around the world. We've got Mark Anderson, the co-head of Global Asset Allocation, Ulrika Hoffman-Bacardi, who's our Global Head of Equities, and Jason Dreho, the Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas. So with that, let's get straight into it. A lot to cover on today's session. So Jason, let's start with you. Could you briefly explain why this decade has been called the Roaring 20s? I know you've been talking about it for a number of months and years now, and give us something of a recap of what we've seen just in the past year.
So, Kieran, you kind of hinted at, you know, why this has been a Roaring 20s decade, and we can put some numbers around it to give context. You can show on the next slide, just for U.S. equity specifically, since the start of the decade, so since December 31st, 2019, the S&P 500 index is up over 80%. Global equities are up over 50%. And this is a story driven, in a lot of cases, by fundamentals. So again, looking at the S&P 500, the earnings for the index are up almost 70%. In a half a decade, that kind of performance is what you'd often get, you know, over a full decade. So kind of by any kind of measure of at least stock market performance, it is roaring. It is a little bit more of a U.S. specific story. You know, the rest of the world hasn't quite done as well, at least on equity front. Or on economic growth, the U.S. has been, you know, the kind of the stronger performer. But certainly for investors, a lot of the, you know, the story for thus far this decade has really been, you know, one of, you know, kind of a very roaring performance overall. If we look back just to this past year for 2024 and think about what's the kind of the lessons we've learned, what is sort of a key takeaway, at least from an economic perspective, I'd say it sort of boils down to, compared to what we expected 12 months ago, the economic outlook in the U.S. globally has been better than expected. And a simple way of measuring that is look at economic growth. In both developed markets and emerging markets, the actual growth we're likely to get this year is higher than, you know, what we forecasted a year ago. That's the chart, the lower left chart on the screen. So for developed markets, we are expecting 1.1%, where it looks like we're going to be on track for 1.7. For emerging markets, you know, 3.9. Instead, we're going to get, you know, 4.4. It's also been a year of continued disinflation. So whether it's in the U.S. where inflation was high, Europe, from very elevated levels 2 years ago, you know, 3 years ago, it's come down steadily, and that progress has continued, you know, thus far this year. So as we near the midpoint of this decade and turn the page, look at 2025 and beyond, these are, you know, relatively good economic conditions, certainly in the U.S., and certainly very good equity market performance to kind of end the first half of this decade.
So a roaring start to the decade, still strong performance in 2024. What's the outlook for 2025?
Well, if you go to the next slide, just thinking about the economic outlook, you know, starting with the U.S., the way I kind of characterize it is it's an outlook of kind of relatively benign growth. Growth has been very strong, but it is moderating. And we still think it's going to be above, you know, sort of 2%, around 2%, so a healthy level. Supported by a consumer that continues to spend, and we're early in the holiday shopping season, but there's no signs of the consumer, in the, at least in the U.S., kind of letting up. Outside of the U.S., it's maybe not quite as good a picture, but you know, still relative to this year, Europe, we expect growth to be a little bit stronger next year, albeit somewhat uneven and still not high in an absolute sense. If you go to Asia, the outlook is a little more murky. In some cases, you know, for China, our expectations of growth is to continue to moderate. But a wild card is sort of in all this, and we'll get to a little bit more, is certainly, you know, the implications of tariffs and how that could sort of impact the rest of the world. Another factor that's part of that whole story, though, is central banks have been cutting rates, you know, this year, and we expect that to continue next year. And that's part of why we have a relatively benign view for, you know, the kind of the economy In the US, from today, we still expect the Federal Reserve to cut 25 basis points in December and a total of 100 basis points next year. Similar for the ECB and other major central banks, except for the Bank of Japan also kind of, you know, cutting as well. So big picture growth, you know, similar to this year, inflation continues to go lower, central banks coming down. All that's a relatively supportive environment for risk assets overall.
Great. Thanks, Jason. You mentioned tariffs. I'm sure many of our viewers will be aware that the US had an election at the beginning of this month, and we've started to see some volatility coming through today as well on some tweets related to tariffs. So perhaps you could just touch on how you expect change in US policy to potentially impact on the US and global economy in 2025.
Well, there are four main ways in which, from an economic perspective, we think, you know, policy can matter for the economy and financial markets. It's through higher tariffs, you know, extending or cutting taxes, deregulation, and changes to immigration policy. And so first and foremost is tariffs, and partly because around 7 p.m. last night, President-elect Trump had, you know, tweeted out, or like whatever you would call it nowadays, suggesting or saying, you know, implementing a 25% tariff on imports from Canada, from Mexico, unless they take certain action to deal with, immigration and, you know, what he claims to be sort of importing drugs into the U.S. So that is sort of an opening salvo. I think expectations are, and our expectations are, there will be tariff increases, probably more focused on China, but, you know, the risk was and remains that tariffs could be applied across other countries. Tariffs ultimately could be inflationary for the U.S. It could be a drag on growth in the U.S. economy, but even more so in other parts of the world, such as Europe and China. So that is certainly in focus, and that is kind of more of a downside risk. A lot of focus also on tax cuts. What we know for certain is that tax cuts that he implemented back in 2018, personal tax cuts, those are set to expire at the beginning of 2026. So focus all up for 2025 is fiscal legislation that would, you presumably extend most, if not all, those tax cuts, as well as discussion and debate around incremental tax cuts, whether it's lowering the corporate tax rate. During the campaign, Trump talked about, you know, no taxes on tips or overtime pay. The constraint on all this is the U.S. fiscal situation. Currently, the U.S. is running a deficit to GDP of around 6.5%, and current forecasts suggest that's going to stay at that level for the foreseeable future. That doesn't include extending those personal tax cuts or incremental tax cuts beyond that. And that's the lower kind of, or the right chart on the slide. You can see that sort of deficit as a ratio of GDP. It's very large. The direction of travel is not getting better. Can the financial markets, can the bond market basically be a constraint on what they do on the fiscal front? Because the more fiscal expansion, the more deficits, the bigger they are, the greater the risk that interest rates could go higher. And that could ultimately be a drag on the economy, but also certainly financial markets. So ultimately, we think the policy, both tariffs, immigration, taxes, and deregulation, you know, will be not as bad as investors feared. And that's why we remain comfortable with this sort of benign growth outlook. But it is certainly a risk. It is certainly a risk that I think investors have to be prepared for. At a minimum, a lot of headline noise as we kind of go from going forward and all through next year.
Great, thank you, Jason. So yeah, decent growth expectations for 2025, some policy-driven volatility perhaps around that. Let's get into the investment implications of all of this. And Ulrika, let's turn to you and on the equity markets. Perhaps you could reflect a little on what we've seen so far this year and what that means and what your outlook is for 2025 in equities.
Yeah, thank you, Karen. Looking back at 2024, I think it's been a year of resilient economic growth and AI promise. And then looking ahead to 2025, I think 25 will be a year of broadening, both for economic growth, but also for AI adoption. We have seen, as Jason mentioned, strong real GDP growth this year. It's projected to come in at 2.8%. As projected by the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. And we see further growth ahead. We expect as CIO for our US earnings, S&P earnings, to increase by 9% year over year next year in 2025. The MAG 7 do have an important role to play in that growth. But over the course of the year, we expect the 493 stocks to gain traction and contribute more than half of the overall S&P earnings by the end of the year in the second half. And the rate cuts that Jason mentioned are very supportive of this economic growth. So I think we are at this sweet spot with economic growth, but yet no imminent pressure from Federal Reserve rate hikes. One thing, of course, to keep in mind are valuations. High valuations are not a ground per se to sell stocks, but they do raise the bar for economic performance. And we are in the top decile of historical valuations since 1985. So companies will have to jump high, but we believe that a contained rate environment and also the policy measures by the US government are going to be a tailwind for US equity markets. That together with the structural forces of AI and power demand.
Great, thanks, Ulrike. And we'll come back to those topics on AI and power and demand shortly. But just first, perhaps we could look a little bit more broadly beyond the US. I think it's clear we have a positive outlook on the US economy and on US equities. What's your perspective on equities more broadly in 2025?
I'm glad you mentioned the word perspective. We recently launched our new equity framework, and we use three perspectives to formulate our overall global equity view: macro, structural, and also bottom-up fundamentals. Very much like three mirrors in a car, we use these views to give us a fuller picture of our surroundings. You might say this is intuitive, but actually it's quite differentiated, as these views are usually institutionally siloed. We see macro funds, thematic funds, and then stock-specific funds. So on these three perspectives, where do we come out? What do the mirrors show for the US equity markets and the broader equity markets? And that's a bright future for 2025. All three views, macro, structural, we just talked about the opportunities in AI and power, and also the well-capitalized large cap companies, are all the basis for further stock market gains in 2025. And maybe just to dive a little bit deeper into the macro, obviously, with the US as the largest economic power in the world, strong US growth bodes well for global equity broadly, and also for global economic growth. And then additionally, China, as the second largest economy, has signaled more willingness for economic stimulus. That's also supportive. And then thirdly, the major central banks are still lowering rates. So all these macro forces are providing quite a strong tailwind. What has maybe slightly shifted since the US election is the distribution of this equity upside. With the new US government and the likely policy measures that you just referenced, Karen, now these measures are reinforcing some of the structural tilts in favor of the US. And Europe and China are the countries that are likely, or regions that are likely, going to bear the brunt of the impending US tariffs. But I think overall, shifting the terms of trade is only reinforcing the structural positioning of the different regions. So where do we see opportunities besides the US, you ask? We see opportunities in Asia ex-Japan, in particular, Taiwan and India. In the whole region, we continue to see above average earnings growth for 2025. And Taiwan is very strongly positioned as the largest foundry for AI chips globally. And then India, on the other side, has upside from expanding its financial services, which is still a very small fraction of GDP today. But also don't count out India for AI. Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, just called out India for its significant increase in demand for AI chips.
Great, thank you, Ulrike. So yeah, opportunities in the US, selected opportunities in Asia as well. Perhaps you'd like to dive in a little more into AI. You've mentioned a few times today, and also the theme of power, which maybe has been a bit less prominent maybe in many investors' mindsets over the recent years, but I think certainly an exciting opportunity. So why don't you fire away on some of the bigger structural opportunities and equities as well?
Yeah, happy to. And, you know, first off, for us at CIO Global Equities, thematic ideas are more than just a headline and a story. We ask ourselves, is this a tangible scale investing opportunity? And will it lead to substantial value creation over many years? And when we ask this question, we see two transformational innovation and investing opportunities at this stage, AI and also power and resources. Both, we believe, will create multi-trillion dollar value creation opportunities over the next decade. AI, we see as the most profound innovation in human history, and the technology that we believe will increase productivity to levels we have not seen before. And this will offer opportunities and currently offers opportunities along the AI value chain, from the enabling layer all the way to the application layer. Currently, we are very focused with our investments on the enabling layer, AI chips and cloud services. But over time, we think this opportunity set will shift to the application layer. Copilots and AI assistants, with those tools, we have only scratched the surface of what type of AI applications we will see. I think the application layer will evolve very similar to what we experienced with the internet. I mean, who would have thought that the internet would turn hitchhiking at scale, I mean, sharing a car with a stranger, into a $150 billion company? So I think the opportunity set is only limited by our own human or maybe AI's imagination. And then the second opportunity that you just mentioned is power and resources. AI is just one source for this increased demand for more electricity. AI needs more and more compute, and compute needs more and more power. So we see significant investment spend driving global electrification over time. And you see in the charts that we think this opportunity set in the enabling layer of electrification in industries such as industrials and utilities will see a growth inflection for the years to come. So both of these opportunities obviously interrelated to some extent, but also in power and resources is driven by demand for more electricity from buildings and vehicles will offer tremendous investing opportunities in parts of the technology, industrial, and utility sectors.
Thank you, Ulrika. So yes, lots of opportunities across US, collected in Asia, and those big themes of AI and power and resources. And I'll remember hitchhiking at scale next time I do a rideshare. Moving beyond equities, let's look at some of the other asset classes and bring you in, Mark, at this point. And just to say, we've got a lot of questions coming in from viewers, so please do keep those coming in. We'll come to those in a moment. But Mark, outside of equities, you know, what are the top ideas across currencies, commodities, and real estate?
Thanks, Kieran. So we obviously heard a lot of exciting stuff around the U.S. And maybe on the first slide here, we have seen that the U.S. dollar has strengthened quite significantly over the last couple of months, really after we got Donald Trump elected. We got sort of the big move, but also as we've been seeing, the U.S. economy has been moving a bit stronger than we expected. Inflation expectations have been moving a little bit up, also on this red sweep as we got. That has moved the dollar quite a bit stronger, a bit against our expectations. And we could see that in the short term, the US dollar would keep some of the strength. However, what we noticed that relative to how yield differentials have been moving, the US dollar has moved a little bit in excess of what we'd be expecting. And we do think that the dollar is relatively overvalued against some of its other major peers when we look over the next couple of years. So what we see as an opportunity in FX is certainly to sell some of the dollar strength we could be getting over the next few months. And we're expecting to see some of the majors like the euro, pound, Swiss franc appreciate against the US dollar, but not to the same extent as we've been expecting before the election results. We do, however, think that the US dollar can be a valuable contributor in a portfolio context. And something that we've been doing in portfolio is been adding US dollar CNY positions. And first and foremost, we changed our forecast here to be 750 after we got the red sweep out of the US. And we do think that if we were to get more significant tariffs, a bit to what Jason was mentioning earlier, we'd certainly see that China would be a bit at the spotlight of some of these tariffs hits. And what we noted last time around was that dollar CNY essentially appreciated around these sort of tariff times. If we move forward to other commodities, and maybe we can talk about alternative currencies, something that many of our clients have been looking at has also been something like Bitcoin. We're very close to hitting sort of 100,000 marks. So we got the Bitcoin moving up, gold prices moving a bit down. But we do tend to have our focus a bit more squarely set on gold. We have a forecast for 2,900 for gold at the end of the year per ounce. And we think that some of the things that Jason talked about earlier, which is rising debt levels in the US, which is currently reasonably unsustainable, I'd say, still a demand for central banks globally to diversify into gold is something that's likely to keep it very well bid. I'm going to piggyback a little bit here on Ulrike as well, not so much the share driving bit, but more in towards the power and resources. We do think that this increasing demand for electricity globally and also for clean energy solution means that we're going to see more of these transition metals being in demand. In the right-hand side of the chart, we see how we're expecting copper demand to increase over time, which is almost a doubling sort of over a decade roughly. So that's likely to drive prices higher. And we think that in broad commodity terms, we have some subsegments here that will do really good in a portfolio context. Again, gold, both with higher debt levels globally, increased geopolitical risk, but also for some of these structural factors that Ulrike very nicely laid out before. If we end on real estate, obviously a sector which has been having a bit of a hard time, to say the least, over the last couple of years globally. We talk a lot about Chinese real estate and the issues there, but we look at it globally, it's been a sector in recession for the last few years, with prices being subdued as well, which is just about to turn now when we've seen sort of central banks starting to cut interest rates. And I'm borrowing here one of the slides that Jason was showing earlier as well. This is just the expectations around what central banks are going to do, which not only in the US we see them continue cutting, but really across the globe, with ECB cutting to a similar magnitude as the Fed, if not even more. So what do we like in real estate? So definitely commercial real estate is something that looks very interesting to us. Investments into infrastructure around data center, again, piggybacking on some of the topics that Ulrike was already mentioning before. But even very traditional residential real estate in places such as Europe, US, look very interesting for us. And the only places we're really shying a little bit away from real estate is places like China and UK partially. And with that, Kieran, back to you.
Great, thanks, Malcolm. We've got lots of questions coming in, so let's get straight to it. Not so long to go, so we keep the answers relatively brief on some very large topics. So let's just start with this one. I'm going to combine a few questions here. So we've got, obviously, trade tensions, geopolitical tensions likely to ramp up in the new Trump administration. How resilient do you think the global economy is? Where is it most likely to be most keenly felt, and the market impact? You can wrap all that up in a couple of minutes, Jason.
All right. So in terms of what we would expect, I'd say our base case, about 65% probability, is selective tariffs. And so they'll be bilateral. You know, the administration will apply tariffs on individual countries for specific reasons, as opposed to a universal tariff where it could be 10% across every import from every country. The selective tariffs, in some sense, that's kind of baked into our baseline economic assumptions. So for the US, if this is imposed, and it could be selective tariffs most likely on China on various goods, but it could also entail selective tariffs on Mexico, because there is a concern that what China is doing is just using Mexico as a way to import it to the US to sort of bypass the tariffs. There could even be tariffs on selective goods from Europe in response to like a digital tax that took place. So, you know, different regions could respond in different ways. The biggest impact on China, except China also has perhaps the biggest scope for policy response to stimulate their economy in response to tariffs. So I think, again, our base case sort of assumes that it really is more of the risk case, where it is a universal tariff that would be much more impactful to the global economy and regions like China, like Europe, that would be impacted, that are very kind of globally oriented with trade. US is a relatively closed economy. It's, you know, there's a percentage of the economy that's trade is much less. So it would be hit, but perhaps less so. And in terms of the impact on financial markets, you know, like our base case, you know, as I talked about for the economy is, you know, benign growth for the US. Alricky, you know, pointed to the, you know, the upside for equities. I also think there is, you know, Trump, you know, this time next year would want to see, you know, the stock market higher. There is a bit of a Trump put in the market, so to speak, that would maybe prevent, again, the more risk scenarios of higher tariffs or things that would be detrimental to the markets. Again, a risk, but not necessarily our base case. So ultimately, you know, for a variety of reasons, we think equity markets go higher under the Trump policies that we anticipate at this time.
Brilliant. Thank you, Jason. Another theme that seems to be coming in is on the question of international diversification. So an observation that the 2020s has not been so roaring for many places outside of the US. And as a result, US equities are now close to 70% in some global equity benchmarks. So to you, Ulrika, what can we expect for markets like Europe? Is it time for international diversification? Can US equities continue to grow their share in global markets?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, when we came into the election, we actually came in with relatively similar geographic preferences. And the reason are our three perspectives, where we look at structural drivers for equity markets as one of the key pillars on how we define the equity outlook. And the US is structurally extremely well positioned when we think about the opportunities in AI, but also electrification. I think Europe has a role to play in electrification also, and there's some really interesting opportunities in Europe, in the space, and also in Asia. But if you look at just how large the companies are that are in the vortex of these very transformational changes, it is heavily biased towards the US. So now the terms of trade further pivot that advantage of the US, at least in the short term. But having said that, valuations are obviously very compressed in other parts of the world. And only if you only move the needle a little bit on economic growth, potential stimulus measures, and maybe allow for a little bit more innovation in Europe, deregulation similar to what the US is experiencing, I do think there can be an opportunity for international diversification. But at this stage, I think it's a little bit too early because valuation by itself is never a reason to buy or sell. You need valuation, low valuation with a catalyst. And I do think there is an opportunity potentially in 2025 for these catalysts to emerge and take a more constructive view on the international opportunities.
Brilliant. Thank you, Ulrika. And just a last question, because I know we're running low on time. Mark, you and I are here in Zurich. Of course, a question close to people's hearts here, the Swiss franc. What's your expectations there?
I'm trying not to be too home biased here, Karen, but if we look back over the last couple of decades, the very traditional safe haven currencies has been US dollar, Japanese yen, and the Swiss franc. And if I start just with portfolio context, one of the reasons that it's interesting to hold currency exposure here is that they tend to appreciate when other parts of the portfolio falls. Put in another way, if you're a Euro-based investor and you have some Swiss equities or US dollar equities, for that matter, you are softening the blow in a sell-off a little bit because these currencies, they tend to appreciate. I'd probably rule out the yen as something as we would think about as a very, very classic safe haven currency, having depreciated quite significantly, obviously a bit more attractively valued. But I think the Swiss franc still sort of plays an important role as a stable pillar in a portfolio. And I'd certainly expect it to appreciate against most other currencies if we were to see geopolitical risks, tensions rising, market sell-off or similar. And we even have dollar Swiss franc expect to appreciate down to 85 towards the middle and end of next year.
Brilliant. Thank you, Mark. This was a great session. Thanks, everybody. We covered a lot of ground there on a benign growth outlook, opportunities in US equities, AI, power and resources, selected opportunities in Asia, as well as some of our key views across gold, transition metals, and currencies and real estate. So thanks, everybody. Sorry we couldn't get to all of your questions. Hopefully, if you can keep following the CIO content, we'll address some of those in time. And with that, I'd just like to say thank you to my guests here for joining. Thank you to the audience all for tuning in. And I hope we'll speak again soon.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/working with us. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.